So hello again to everyone, and thank you for joining me in this final and fourth lecture. And without further ado, we'll start to talk today about Sheshank, this great Egyptian king. Definitely, as far as the Bible is concerned, this is the greatest Egyptian king. And what I wanted to show you today is that this was a great king in Egypt as well, in the Levant as well. The kind of biblical information that we have about him certainly relies on some true memory and maybe also some records that were in front of the redactors. In 1937, a very important book was written by Simmons. It's called The Handbook of Egyptian Topographical Lists of Western Asia. And it brought for the first time all the material from these lists of the campaigns of the great pharaohs, mostly of the New Kingdom. And at the end of the book, there was this list, also not from the New Kingdom, from the Third Intermediate Period. And Simmons wrote about this. Here you have the French, I read it in English. Sheshank's topographical list stands out among all other lists by its direct bearing on biblical history, and consequently upon the event on which it is based, by its topographical limitation to Palestine. And this was noted immediately by people who already were in Egypt even 100 years earlier, just like we have here a very comprehensive list of references by early travelers and scholars to Egypt. Some of them published just a little bit of the inscription, some of them published a little bit of the relief. Finally, the definitive publication by the Oriental Institute, the Chicago Oriental Institute, Reliefs and Inscriptions at Karnak, Volume 3, the Bubastide Portal, is to this day the epigraphic, the complete epigraphic record of this list. And this specialness of the list was immediately recognized by Simmons, because when he gathered all the other lists of Western Asia in the Egyptian records, so the lists of the Thutmeses and the Amenhoteps and the Ramessides and so on, he could see that there was a lot of copying being done from one list to the other. And as these were entire sections that were replicated in the different lists, their historical value as actual, you know, references to specific campaigns and places became diminished because of this copying procedure. Whereas the list of Sheshank was very obviously original. It did not contain copies of earlier lists. So this was the first thing that for Simmons as an Egyptologist was amazing. Of course, the other thing is the fact that for the first time we have a king campaigning in Palestine, ancient Israel, and this king is already mentioned in the biblical source. And the biblical source from the Book of Kings says that in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. He carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon has made. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the royal palace. Whenever the king went to the Lord's temple, the guards bore the shields, and afterward they returned them to the guard room. So here we have a biblical, very clear reference, which repeats itself and is elaborated also in the Book of Chronicles, which I believe everyone will agree is a much later version, and we don't necessarily consider it more historical than this one. So really the first time that we have such a link. We have, because usually the Bible does not name the Egyptian king, they call him only Pharaoh. And here, for the first time, we have a specific Pharaoh. At the same time, we have other records in Egypt. Of course, this relief, this list of names from Karnak Temple is the most famous. But we have other records in Egypt that tell us about the campaign, or the campaigns, in plurals, of Sheshonq I. So we have the triumphal relief in Karnak, but there is also a victory stela in Karnak. It's a bit broken, a bit worn out, not complete, but it's definitely a victory stela that we know the kind. There is also in the temple of El Khiba, which is in the center of Egypt, we have one of those scenes of smiting an enemy, which we talked about last time. So we have a scene of Sheshonq smiting an enemy. We have a biographical inscription from the tomb of Hor, who was a general in the army of Sheshonq. And in this inscription, he tells how he followed the king, Sheshonq, to his campaign, possibly campaigns. There is a slight problem with reading either one or more, into Palestine. And finally, we also have some finds like this altar from Heracleopolis Magna, which indirectly refer to the Egyptian army of Sheshonq's time. So we are usually thinking just about the triumphal relief, but of course there are more indications, more corroborations for this event in Egypt. From the Levant, already in 1937, when Siemens wrote his topographical lists, we already found in 1926, actually, and published in 1929, this big piece of stone with the cartouche, the two cartouches of Sheshonq at the site of Megiddo. We will come back to that in more detail in a few minutes. Also, from Byblos, there are the remains of three larger-than-life-size statues of the Egyptian kings of the 22nd dynasty. It's Sheshonq I and his successors, Osorkon I and Osorkon II. So we have here the dynasty that is represented in Byblos in big statues. We'll have a look at that in a minute, too. Finally, a few years ago, a scarab with the name of Sheshonq was found in the copper districts of Fainan in Jordan, in the western side of the Araba, the eastern side of the Araba. And although this was a surface find, unfortunately, like all good finds, it is unusual because it is the first scarab of Sheshonq I to be found outside of Egypt. And to be found especially in Fainan, and because we know, and I will talk about this later, that the list of Sheshonq, part of its originality is the fact that it deals with names of places in the Negev, in the south of Israel. So to find this Sheshonq scarab specifically in a southern site is quite incredible, I think. So these are the sources, basically, that we have: the Egyptian sources, the Levantine sources, the biblical sources. And it does seem that in a very unusual and exciting way, they all kind of come together for the first time in our biblical sequence in this book of Kings. However, the interpretation that was given to these sources has been on two different lines of interpretation. One interpretation was, and this is really the common scholarship, that Pharaoh Sheshonq's venture into the Levant was a short-lived affair. So there was the campaign, he reached wherever he reached, and then immediately came back. and it had no real effect on the history of ancient Israel. However, the possibility of uninterrupted Egyptian influence in the Levant from Sheshonq I until the Battle of Karkar, 853 BCE, has already been suggested by some scholars. So sometimes in passing, for example, Benjamin Zass wrote it in a footnote. Axel Knauf was already a little bit more persuasive in an article from 2007. You have it all in your bibliography, in your handouts. And then in recent years, more and more by myself and by Israel Finkelstein. So there is here something that we should try to critically assess if we can choose one of those interpretations and prefer one of them. And in order to do that, we need to find a little bit more about the nature of Egypt under the reign of Sheshonq, something that is mostly left uncriticized or unexplored by the people who write about this campaign. And we would need more information about the campaign itself. When, where, why, these kind of questions that need to be answered. So let's begin a little bit with Sheshonq's reign. So I bring you back a little bit to the chronology that we have been discussing in the last 4 weeks. We are after the New Kingdom era, the Great Empire is finished. We are in the immediately after that, in the 21st dynasty, when the Egyptian kingdom is split between two regions. There is a house of pharaohs in Tanis controlling the delta, the lower Egypt, and we have a dynasty of high priests of Amun that are controlling Thebes and upper Egypt, and on occasion these high priests of Amun call themselves kings and represent themselves with all the iconography of a king and even count the years in Thebes according to their reignal years. And this goes on until the last king of the 21st dynasty, Susenes II, passes away without any direct heir. And for this event, this person, which we heard about a little bit in the record already under Susenes II, Shishak, Sheshonq in the Egyptian records, he is already a general in the army of Susenes. He is married into the royal family of Susenes by his wife. He is the son of the great chief of a Libyan tribe that lives in the delta already for at least a century since the end of the New Kingdom. And so it's not someone who comes out of nowhere. He is already very much part of this ruling elite of Tanis, and he gets the throne, and so he becomes the founder of the 22nd dynasty, which will be a complete Libyan dynasty. And their Libyan side is attested by their names, first of all. So no more these Egyptian names, Theophoric names that we know, but really completely Libyan names that we don't exactly understand the meaning of the name. But for all other purposes and appearances, this will look like a complete Egyptian pharaonic traditional reign. And it's just the names that will tell us that it's Libyan and some of the hierarchy within the reign. At first, when Sheshonq comes to the throne, he is the heir of Susenes II, which means that he rules in Tanis, in Lower Egypt. At the same time, There is a high priest of Amun in Thebes, which rules Upper Egypt. But within 5 years from the beginning of Sheshonq's rule, we find that things are different. And now in Thebes, the Nile levels in Karnak, the Nilometer, where you write each year how high the Nile has got to, the Nile levels now appear with the cartouche of Sheshonq rather than the high priest of Amun. And by the year 10, the high priest of Amun in Thebes is no longer from the dynasty of priests that we knew. It is now the son of Sheshonq I, Yuput. In this way, Sheshonq effectively reunites both parts of Egypt under his single rule from Tanis. And as he does this, and we don't have information about whether this was an easy process or whether this was also some kind of conflict between the house of Amun in Thebes and the house of Shishak in Tanis, but as he does this, he reestablishes all the conventions of the new kingdom, of the empire period, and the triumphal relief that we are all so familiar with is exactly in this tradition. It is the reestablishment of this tradition. And so in Karnak, we find his relief here on the side. We have to think of Karnak. This is Karnak at its full blown, this plan. But you have to think of Karnak in the 22nd dynasty, in the time of Sheshonq. This first pylon is not existing yet. This first court is not existing yet. The Karnak temple starts with this pylon, has this temple of Ramses III on the side, and this temple of Seti on the other side. And the first thing that we can say with relation to the reestablishment of traditions of the new kingdom empire is that on this wall, this outer wall, we have many triumphal reliefs, exactly like the ones of Sheshonq, that belong to previous kings, the Ramessides. And so he's really just here on the side of the second pylon, adding a little wall and putting his own triumphal relief right here between the triumphal reliefs of Ramses II and between the temple of Ramses III, who, by the way, here on the pylon of the temple of Ramses III, also has the same kind of triumphal reliefs. So he's really delving into this culture. Here we see it from the side. Okay, so this is the second pylon, what you see up here, what is left from it. Here you enter into the first courtyard, which at the time was not a courtyard at all. It was just beyond the temple. Here to the right would be the outer wall of the hypostyle hall with all the triumphal reliefs of Ramses II. And here is the temple of Ramses III. So this is the new section, so to speak. And if we look at the drawing of the epigraphic survey, we can see this traditional view of the king. We can only see very little of him. You see the skirt, you know, and the white crown of Upper Egypt. And we see one hand holding the captives by their hair. And the other arm is raised up in the air, holding a mace. You see the mace, the end of the mace right here. And he is about to strike down his enemies. This is the classic smiting scene of the Egyptian king, already from the very humble beginnings of the pre-dynastic era. In front of him is the god Amun. Underneath, the goddess Waset, victorious Thebes. Both the deities are holding ropes, and the ropes are connected to the necks of these poor Asiatic people. I think we have an enlargement of this part. So we know they are Asiatic because according to Egyptian conventions of the New Kingdom era, from all the triumphal reliefs, if you want to put the representation of an Asiatic, this is how they will look. They will have a beard, a nice hairdo, yeah, like a carré, and a band on the forehead, which is stringed behind the head in a tie. They are bearded. Of course, the Egyptians are not bearded. And these are the Asiatics. Their hands are bound behind their backs. They have a rope binding their necks, thank you. And instead of a body, they have this Egyptian convention of a walled city. So for the Egyptians, the cities in Asia were always considered to be walled cities, whether they were or not. And so this is the convention for a city in Asia. And the name of the city is written inside this. So together, this is a representation of a subdued Asiatic place names. And this is how all the Egyptian triumphal reliefs are done, exactly like that. You have an inscription on the upper part. You see, this part is the inscription, all these hieroglyphs. Then you have the smiting scene of the king, and you have the deities with the name rings, which we call toponyms sometimes. Here we have the same exact function, much earlier, Seti the First, Ramesside king, in the 13th century BC, and we have the king smiting his enemies. They are all together. We have the god, another deity, and they're all carrying these toponyms. And in the Egyptian sense, what we are seeing here is a little story. The story is this. The god Amun, or any other major deity, is giving the scimitar sword to the king. He is handing the king the sword, which means that he's giving a royal, a divine decree to go to war, to protect the country. The king is not going on this campaign just because he decided to go to this campaign on his own. It is the order of the deity. So the deity gives the order to go to war. The king goes to war. Here he is at war against his enemies. And then he brings back these captives, which are the booty, the loot, the conquered cities, the captives themselves. He brings them back to the god, to Amun. So it's a circular story which is happening in this scene, in this triumphal scene. Not all triumphal scenes can be equated with actual campaigns. It was the duty of the Egyptian king to subdue the enemies of Egypt. It was his duty towards the gods, because by subduing the enemies of Egypt, he was maintaining the integrity of Egypt. The integrity of Egypt was necessary in order to uphold the most important cosmic concept of ancient Egypt, which was the Ma'at. Ma'at, literally truth, but also balance, harmony. And the balance and the harmony cannot be maintained if we have all these foreigners coming into Egypt. And so this is why all these reliefs are always on the outer walls of temples and not in palaces, for example, because they are done to show the gods that I, the king, am fulfilling my commitment to the gods and keeping the Ma'at. Because if the king does not keep the mat, and it is his sole responsibility to keep the mat, if the king does not keep the mat, terrible things will happen. The Nile will not overflow. There will be a drought. The grains will not grow. Egypt will starve. This is all a consequence of not upholding the mat. So it is well known that these reliefs didn't always represent actual campaigns, as is also evident from the fact that I began by saying that many of these lists of names are replicated from previous lists. That this is part of the practice of triumphal reliefs, and their ideological and cultic role in ancient Egypt. However, as I started, Sheshonq's list has some originalities. The first is the place names that we have. The second is in the inscription here in this part. Usually this inscription is a very standard inscription that talks about the royal decree and about the divine decree and about the greatness of the pharaoh in front of his enemies, his power and prowess. All this exists, of course, in this text of Sheshonq, but here in the middle we have a very unusual insertion, that talks about building activities in Egypt. And he says, I have built for you, for the god, monuments in southern On. Southern On is the name of Thebes. And in northern On, which is the name of Heliopolis. And in every town for its own deity. So inside this very standard inscription, Sheshonq puts in his monumental building activities around Egypt. It is unusual, and it focuses on the fact that Sheshonq is not just here in Thebes or just in Tanis. He is trying to rebuild the Egyptian control even in the more remote places of the Egyptian kingdom. And for example, I would just say one more thing about this before the example. He's talking here about doing things in Karnak and in Heliopolis. As far as Karnak is concerned, as I showed before, we have this relief, but we also know that he started doing work inside the first courtyard here. So he was trying to make more monuments at Karnak itself, and we have the beginning of this court by Sheshonq. And at the same time, from very remote places, such as Dakhla, the oasis, Edfu, all the way in the south, Tel Tabila, all the way in the eastern delta, so really a kind of bordering to the farthest reaches of the Egyptian kingdom, we have monuments of this king. Here we find a block, here we found a portal for a Khebsed, for a jubilee. And all these things, when they are starting to come together, we find that although the monuments in themselves may not have survived because the blocks were used and reused by later kings, they were there. And this Sheshonq was quite a prolific builder beyond what we know of other kings of the third intermediate period. And beside that, of course, we have many sites in the delta next to Tanis, where there are huge monuments, some of them reusing Ramesside blocks from the area, but still huge monuments that were erected by Sheshonq. And I briefly mentioned this before, also a new temple for Amun in El Khiba. El Khiba here in Middle Egypt. This was formerly the border between the Tanit rule of Lower Egypt and the Theban rule of Upper Egypt. And under the reign of Sheshonq, it is no longer a border town. It's now an important town of the 22nd dynasty with a new temple for Amun. And again, as a temple befits, there is a smiting scene of Sheshonq. This is all that is left from this smiting scene, because again, there was heavy reuse and rebuild in these areas. Okay, once more Karnak, just to show this area that was also built by Sheshonq. So, if I want to give us a little summary until here, we have monumental building activities across the land, even in remote places. We have jubilee celebrations, the Cheb Sed, the feast of the king. Again, a new kingdom tradition that is redone by Sheshonq. We have new cultic places for Amun-Re, also for Apis-Bul in Memphis. This is the Heracleopolis Magna altar. We have projects in the Temple of Karnak, for which he also reopened some of the ancient quarries in the desert. So again, if you have to imagine that we need to quarry large stones from the desert in order to build in Karnak, this is a very big project. Sheshonq left his inscription in those quarries. And we have, of course, the re-initiation of campaigns into the Levant, which is one of the main characteristics of the New Kingdom era. So what do we know? We know a lot about Sheshonq in Egypt, and I hope that you agree with me that this was indeed one of the great kings of Egypt, just that we are less aware of this because of conditions of preservation and so on. So what can we say about the campaign itself? Unfortunately, the great inscription that we just talked about does not contain a date. It doesn't say in the 5th year, in the 10th year, in the 11th year. We don't know exactly when it was, unlike the biblical source that says that it was in the 5th year of Rehoboam. But as we mentioned before, it cannot be before the 5th year, because before that, Sheshonq was not in Thebes. He was only in Tanis. And the last year, known year of his reign, is the 21st year of his reign, which is also the year of the quarrying in the quarries next to Thebes. And so we are somewhere between year 5 and 21. But I think that when you look at this relief in Karnak, it is very clear that it comes at an early stage of his reign. The first thing is, of course, this idea that I'm talking about building all over Egypt. This is a clear message to the Theban population, the Theban elites, those high priests of Amun that just lost their dynasty. This is a clear message that says, I am now king of all Egypt. This is not just a little coup d'etat that I'm having here. The other thing, very interesting, I mentioned it briefly, is the white crown of Upper Egypt, which Sheshonq is wearing in the inscription. Usually in triumphal reliefs, the white crown does not appear. It's either the double crown, white and red, Upper and Lower Egypt. And the fact that we have just the Upper Egypt here also tells us there is a message towards these people. Also, for reasons of the architecture that I'm not going to get into now, it seems that the triumphal relief on the side of the pylon was started before the remaining architecture inside the first court. So I would place it somewhere between year 5 and 10. The other things that we know is the place names, which are really previously unknown in Egyptian lists. We have Negev and many sites that are with this toponym Negev. So it's in the south of Israel. We have areas, cities or place names in the central hills or going into the central hills, such as Bet Horon and Ayalon. And at the same time, we have some toponyms in the Gilad, so in Transjordan, on the other side. And these are all new to the Egyptian lists. I just want to say a little thing about this map. This map is from the publication by Kitchen. Kenneth Kitchen is a very important Egyptologist who wrote the first book about the history of the Third Intermediate Period. Without Kenneth Kitchen, we would not be talking about any of the history of the Third Intermediate Period. We would still be talking about the New Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom and the Old Kingdom and not about this unimportant era. However, in this map, and you have this his book in the bibliography, in this map, there are some assumptions. Allegedly, this is a map of the names that are in the list of Shishak. But for example, Gaza is not mentioned in the list. This is a reconstruction that Kenneth Kitchen suggests. So this is always a problem when you look at a map. You have to read the entire book, otherwise you don't understand that this is a reconstruction. In fact, it's very unusual that the first toponym is not Gaza. In almost all the Egyptian lists going into Palestine, the first toponym is Gaza, not this time. We have a few places in the Negev. Arad is the most important one. We have here Ayalon, Bet Horon. Bet El is not mentioned. And most of all, Tirza is not mentioned in the Shishank list. Again, this is a reconstruction, and Tirza is the important early Israelite capital of the northern Israelite kingdom, and this is why it's very tempting to put it into the campaign list, but again, this is a reconstruction. So what we can say for sure is that we have names in the Negev area, we have names just as you're going up into the hill country, but we don't have names actually in the hill country. We have names in the Gilad, and then we have the more usually known names in Egyptian lists in the northern valleys. So this is definitely the areas that the campaign is talking about. And then there was, for many years, this attempt to co-sign destruction layers in the Levant, in all these name place names, and the campaign of Shishank. And this wasn't always easy. And, you know, for this game, because it's, you have to know when to put exactly this campaign of Shishank. So just for example, yeah, in Megiddo, unfortunately, the famous fragment with Shishank's name was, you can imagine, found out of its context. So ex situ, like all the good finds, of course. And so during the many years since it was found, we had this Shishank associated with Megiddo 6A, which is a Iron 1 strata, or with the partial destruction, with the 6A has a very big destruction, or with the partial destruction of a later strata, Megiddo 5A, 4B, or with no destruction at all in an even later strata of 5B. So all these have been suggested in scholarship, and the truth is that now that we have new carbon 14 data, from Megiddo, but also from other sites, it's pretty clear that these destruction layers of the Iron One period come in different points in the Iron One. It's not one event of destruction at Megiddo and at other sites. Each had some destruction at a different time. So it's very hard to say, okay, all these destructions are from the campaign of Shishank. And so we're not going to play that game anymore. Anyway, then we had a new kind of information because we have the site of Arad. And Arad was excavated in the Beersheba Valley. And when you look at the levels at Arad, and you see that you have Arad in the list, you have less options than you had at Megiddo. Megiddo is a multi-period site and with very complex stratigraphy. But in Arad, the only level that could be relevant to the 10th century is Arad level 12. And this is already agreed by, I think, all the archaeologists that are working in Israel today. And this Arad level 12 is before the great fort of Arad that we know from the 9th century or a bit later. And it has a very unique assemblage. Here we can see just a part of it. It has a very unique assemblage of pottery. And in the early 2000s, two very able archaeologists, Lili Zinger Avitz and Zeev Herzog, published a few articles on this special assemblage of Arad 12 and showed that this could be called the early iron 2A assemblage. And they could trace this early iron 2A horizon to other sites in ancient Israel, and also to this new phenomena of a settlement in the Negev Highlands, which is again happening specifically in the early iron 2A. So we can now say that if we want to find the campaign of Sheshonq, we should go to the iron 2A levels. And we can also have this today with radiometric dates, carbon 14 dates from the Negev Highland sites that put it all in the 10th century. So it's a very solid ground, I believe, today to look at the Sheshonq campaign and say it's not iron 1, it's iron 2A. And if we identify this Sheshonq horizon in the early iron 2A, it's very significant because these strata did not suffer any destruction. And their prosperity began contemporaneously with the campaign and continued after Sheshonq's reign. And so this association suggests that rather than destroying parts of Israel, the campaign had an actual role in initiating and promoting at least some of the early iron 2A settlement phenomena. And the truth is that this is not a big surprise when you consider the nature of Egyptian triumphal relief. There's no reason to assume that the Egyptian campaigns in Western Asia, already in the New Kingdom period, were aimed at destroying the potentially lucrative domains of the Levant. And this has been argued by many Egyptologists and archaeologists. Rather, the opposite is often the case. It is possible that a certain site was destroyed upon a specific conflict, but the scorched ground practice was never favored by the Egyptian expansionism, as it goes against the intended exploit of the land. It is also worth noting that the symbolic meaning of the triumphal relief, as we discussed, does not imply destruction of the named toponyms, but rather their subjugation and delivery of tribute to the Egyptian temples. And such tribute is also the focal point of the biblical description of the campaign that we just read at the beginning. So I would say that this comes in quite nicely. Other evidence for Sheshonq in the Levant comes from the statues from Byblos, from which we have only parts, but it's the important parts, the one with the cartouche. So we can read the name of Sheshonq the First, of Osorkon the First, where we have multiple pieces. Here we have a foot, here we have a, here another piece of the back, and so on. And also a statue of Osorkon the Second. So all these kings are in Byblos attested. And if you remember, I just said that the Iron 2A is a settlement phase that lasts after Sheshonq's reign. And this is not surprising that we have this phase, which at least in Byblos we can see, continues also to Osorkon I and Osorkon II. And we know of Egyptian royal statues in the Levant already from the New Kingdom period. Again, this is a New Kingdom phenomena. This is Ramses III from Bet She'an, with one big difference. These statues were made in Egypt because they are made of a kind of stone that cannot be found in the Levant and is special for Egyptian statues in Egypt, while this basalt stone was a local Bet She'an stone. It was made in Bet She'an and not in Egypt. So we have, again, a different kind of rule, if you like. As we go now to the famous fragment from Megiddo, it was found, as I said, in 1926, published by Fisher in 1929. And in the publication, this was the reconstruction. So that this is the little piece here. And it was part of a very, very large stela of over 2 meters, probably more, that had the image of the king and the deities and the whole text. This is really the kind of imagery that we find in New Kingdom stela. And on the very small piece here, we can read, in fact, these words, given all life, stability, and dominion. So this is a dialogue between the king and the god. The good god, this is the name of Sheshonq, lord of ritual performance, Sheshonq, beloved of Amun. This is a very standard inscription that you put on a temple usually, and it's very known from other parts of Egypt. However, a few years ago, I went to the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem to actually see this fragment of a stela. And when I saw this fragment of a stela, I was quite amazed because I found out that it is 70 centimeters wide. So I have never heard of a stela, which is the thickness of is 70 centimeters, 50 centimeters and more, because the back is not finished, so it could have been more than 50 centimeters. Never heard of anything so thick. And as I looked at this piece, it became evident that the initial reconstruction of it as part of a stela, and this part was in the Fisher reconstruction, this was thought to be the end of the lunette, where it had kind of a curve. Upon closer observation, there is no curve, and this is impossible that this was actually a stela. Yes, just for example, the greatest stela that we have is from Bet She'an, from the New Kingdom. It's made of basalt, like all other stela in the Levant. It's never made of limestone, like the Sheshonq from Megiddo. And this is 34 centimeters thick. It's very thick. And if you like to see other stela from the Levant, you can read it in Eitan Levy's article. Thank you, Eitan. And so I had to go back to point zero, and I found this picture taken at Megiddo. And the funny thing is that I walked past this picture almost every day when I was excavating in Megiddo and never realized that this was the Sheshonq stela that Henry Breasted is looking at. And so this is what he wrote in his journal. On my first arrival at the mound, after work had begun in the spring of 1926, Dr. Fisher informed me that a fragment inscribed with Egyptian hieroglyphs had been brought down from the top of the mound as a building block during the construction of the house. They were building the house for the expedition, which now houses the visitor center at Megiddo. And they were building this house, and they were taking from the mound large blocks that they can use. They were doing exactly what everyone was doing in the Levant and in Egypt for millennia. And of course, it was intended to be used as a block, because it is a block. Yeah, you can see here, it was never a stela. And it's a big question. How come this was published by Fischer, who was not an Egyptologist at all? And he could not even bring good parallels from third intermediate period Egypt, but only from New Kingdom. And we are left with this kind of error. And if you look in Karnak Temple, for example, in the Bubastite portal of Sheshonq, you can recognize immediately that this is the same kind of inscription that you put on a temple wall. It's also the same kind of size of the cartouche. It's not a size that is relevant for a stela. And I have no other alternative than to say that this is a building block. So there was a building at Megiddo at some point. It's made out of the local limestone. All the buildings in Megiddo are made of this stone. There was a building at Megiddo at some point that was inscribed with a short inscription by Sheshonq I. We have other examples of building blocks inscribed with hieroglyphs in Israel. This is a very large block from the site of Gezer. Unfortunately, Gezer was excavated in a way that in the very early 20th century, in a way that is impossible today to say where this block came from. It could come from a New Kingdom context, late Bronze Age, or it could come from a later one, which would be very, very interesting. But of course, there's no way to know this. So, if I have to bring everything back now together, because it's 5 minutes to 12. So what is the impact of all this on the Levant? We have in the districts, the copper districts, an intensification of the activity in the copper mines. This intensification, if you read this article, you have it also in your handout, was accompanied by a new technology. There was a technological leap at the mines at the 10th century BCE, and now we also know that the mines in Timna were also operated at the 10th century BCE. We now have radiocarbon dating. So this was one very important impact. Another is, and we discussed this in the previous lessons, in lecture number 2, about how in the early Iron 2A, all of a sudden we have much more Egyptian pottery, also locally produced, also in the Negev, in the Be'er Sheva Valley, in Tel Masos, in Tel Esdar, these apparently out-of-the-way kind of sites, and still we have in them locally produced Egyptian pottery and imported pottery, and we have an increase in amulets, in commodities, in Nile perch, for example. All this happens specifically in the early Iron 2A. Another thing that happens specifically in the Iron 2A is this new settlement system in the Negev Highlands, which was once considered to be the forts of the Israelite kingdom and so on, but today we know that they are not forts because they don't really have walls, defending walls. These are very thin walls. And from researchers done on the geoarchaeology, on the sediments inside these forts, we know that they were used for herding in cattle. So it was a different settlement system altogether, and we now suspect, again, according to some new research, that it was connected with the movement of copper from Fainan to Egypt, but also to the coast, because all this copper that was coming from Fainan needed to be shipped to the major customers. So this is also a new impact in the 10th century BCE. So if I conclude, Sheshonq's campaign did not operate in a void of Egypto-Levantine interactions. As we saw earlier in the seminar, the Iron Age I already saw continued influence of Egyptian culture in the Levant. We had commodities and we had maritime exchange. We have the nice pottery from Dor and so on, and Kassila and all the coastal sites. So Nile perch continued to be important, and others, such as copper, continued to be exported from the southern Levant to Egypt. This is a recent article by myself and Erez Ben Yosef, a metallurgist, and this shows that copper from the 21st dynasty in Egypt, so royal shabtis, figurines of the kings of the 21st dynasty in Egypt, so just a minute before Sheshonq, these bronze objects contained copper from Feinan. So we already know that there was not a void. There was always a connection. And into this world, we should see the Sheshonq campaign through this prism of an existing or at least an evolving cultural empire of Egypt in the Levant. And his campaign in this sense, beyond the justification of gaining control of copper sources and gaining control of grain sources and all the good things that the Egyptians always wanted in the Levant, is also the result of the tension between colonial imperialism and cultural imperialism. Because the campaign is the legitimation of the force of empire in its postmodern sense that we talked about here. And it is a critical formational phase in which the empire's force is legitimized by its effectiveness. So the ability of Sheshonq to intervene in the Levant was making his rule in Egypt stronger. It was giving him the legitimization that he needed in order to be this king of the entire Egypt and not just the king of Tanis. And if you want, there is a little citation from this book of Hart and Negri on empire, this empire without territory. And during its formation, the new power must demonstrate the effectiveness of its force at the same time that the basis of its legitimation are being constructed. And this is exactly what is happening in this era in Sheshonq. The effectiveness is expressed through the regulation and exploitation of production, which are achieved not by holding the ground, but by proving that you are the most effective force and being the main consumption market for copper, oil, wine. The effectiveness of your force and therefore your legitimacy to regulate and dominate exchange is expressed through propaganda rather than physical sovereignty. Leaving your cartouche on an important state building and not a stela, which anyone can throw off, is the way of this cultural empire. This phase of Egyptian domination probably lasted until Osorkon II, the last king of the 22nd dynasty that exerted control over Egypt in its entirety and whose statue was placed in Byblos, and who most likely is the Egyptian king mentioned among the allies in the Battle of Karkal with the king of Israel. And not surprisingly, an alabaster vase carrying the name of Osorkon II was found at Samaria. So the Sheshonq campaign was all that was needed to reaffirm the alliances and cultural affiliation of the southern Levant in the early Iron IIa. And so during the early Iron Age, Egypt was not a sleeping giant that all of a sudden woke up and did this razzia in the Levant. It was a dominant, powerful empire that influenced the southern Levant culturally without the actual need of a territorial subjugation. Thank you very much.